You know, it wasn't long ago, I think maybe it was August 2020 actually, when we aired an Abbott Nutrition Health Institute podcast episode on oncology and nutrition. And it addressed the topic through the lens of COVID-19, focusing on a multidisciplinary team approach to nutrition care for oncology patients. We received a lot of great feedback about that recording and about some of the other oncology education we produced in 2020. And through it all, we saw one long thread of thought tying together this feedback, and that was the need for more oncology nutrition content as told through a variety of other lenses, not just COVID-19. So that's what we're here to do today. In November 2020, we were lucky enough to sit down with a roundtable of experts to continue the discussion on this important topic of oncology and nutrition. And now we're reconvening so you can hear our experts' insights for yourself through a 3-episode podcast series. Today in this first episode, we'll talk about the importance of exercise and nutrition for patients with cancer. In episode 2, we'll discuss preoperative and rehabilitation nutrition. And in the 3rd episode, we'll talk about multimodal interventions in cancer patients with and without cachexia. I'm Mara Bowen, podcasting for Abbott Nutrition Health Institute, and joining me today is Dr. Anthony Sung, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Division of Hematologic Malignancies and Cellular Therapy, as well as Associate Director of the Duke Microbiome Center at Duke University School of Medicine in Durham, North Carolina, here in the United States. And today, Dr. Sung will talk about the benefits of exercise during cancer treatment. He'll review the latest evidence on exercise regimens for people with cancer, and he'll explain the role exercise and nutrition can play to help improve outcomes. And even though we're talking about exercise today, I'm going to avoid talking to Dr. Sung about Duke versus University of Kentucky basketball, which we know is a hoops rivalry for the ages. Am I right, Dr. Sung?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, great. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and please call me Tony.
All right. So first, I should note that since we're still in the middle of a pandemic, Tony and I are both dialing in from the comfort of our offices rather than recording together in the studio. So today's recording quality may sound a little different from what you're used to hearing. And secondly, Tony, here's our chance to properly introduce you. So would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself, your name, your current role, and your background?
Absolutely. I am a hematopoietic stem cell transplant physician, first and foremost. I take care of patients with leukemia, lymphoma, and other blood cancers who could benefit from transplantation, which is a potentially life-saving curative procedure. I'm also a clinician investigator because I recognize while we have many successful cancer therapies, they're not enough, and we need to improve the quality of our therapies and outcomes for our patients. My research is quite broad. It runs the gamut from mouse studies, where we will test new theories or compounds in our animal models, which we will then translate to phase 1 and then eventually phase 2 and phase 3 clinical trials. I also do a lot of correlative studies where we look at patients who are getting cancer treatments or who are enrolled in clinical trials, and we look at samples from their blood or their stool when we're looking at their microbiome, the bacteria residing in their gut, to see how changes in those biomarkers or the microbiome are associated with transplant and other clinical outcomes. Our overall goal through this information is to come up with new therapies that we can use to help modulate human health and improve treatment outcomes.
Perfect. Thank you for that background. So I know we've known for years that it's important for people with cancer to really stay as active as they possibly can during treatment. But why is physical activity so important to the process?
So we commonly say that the better you are coming into therapy, whether it's transplant or chemotherapy or radiation therapy, whatever it is, we are placing a tremendous stress on your body. And so the better you are coming into that therapy, the better you do during the therapy and the better your outcomes are after therapy. And at least in the field of stem cell transplant, this can be quite dramatic. Survival is significantly improved in patients who come to us with good physical function, good nutrition, compared to those who come to us who are already impaired in those areas.
And clearly, when you're not feeling well, like when your energy is low or you feel weak or you feel nauseous and all the other side effects of this disease, it can be really hard to stay motivated to exercise. Can you speak to some of those challenges?
Absolutely. You know, we often see patients who come in, they are newly diagnosed with their cancer, they're motivated to do everything they can to help beat it, including eating well and exercising. But then chemotherapy and radiation and other treatments will cause fatigue. They will cause anorexia or loss of appetite, nausea, as you mentioned. And then it can be very difficult for our patients to maintain that initial good intentions and very difficult for them to maintain their level of fitness and nutrition. even patients who come to us very fit, you know, athletes, military veterans, others who are in good shape may find that the treatment takes quite a toll on their body. But this also speaks to why it's so important to try to maintain that level of fitness or to improve that level of fitness as much as possible, both prehabilitation before the intervention, as well as while receiving chemotherapy or transplant or other interventions, and then also for recovery. And I think one of the things that we're working on to try to help patients get through these challenging times, not only with medications to help address the nausea or to help encourage their appetite, but also I think coaching and counseling and the importance of that. You know, earlier I talked about physical resilience, physical fitness, good nutrition, but I also think that an important part is psychological resilience, you know, that mentality to keep pushing through, even when you don't have an appetite to go ahead and drink down that protein shake, or when you're tired to still get out of bed and walk that lap or get that exercise in. And I think that's so important to overall outcomes.
Can you tell us about some of the clinical evidence that supports the type and duration of exercise needed for cancer patients?
Absolutely. There's been a ton of research on the importance of exercise for cancer patients and during cancer therapy. It's a little tricky almost because there's so much research, it can be overwhelming, and a lot of it is disease and content specific. For example, for breast cancer patients versus leukemia patients versus prostate cancer patients. But overall, if I were to summarize the general field, many research studies show that having moderate intensity exercise 10 to 45 minutes per day, 4 to 6 days per week, can reduce cancer-related fatigue, depression, and anxiety. It can improve cardiopulmonary function, and it can ultimately improve cancer outcomes. In addition to moderate intensity or cardiovascular exercise, there's also evidence supporting resistance training. There have been exercise trials of resistance training or weight training that have shown exercise will increase lean body mass, muscle protein mass, and improve physical function, which is especially important because a lot of our cancer patients during the course of chemotherapy, as we talked about earlier, will lose muscle mass and lose deleterious effects on the quality of their muscle, where they have more intramuscular fat and less healthy functioning muscle. And these things can be counteracted by things like resistance exercises or cardiopulmonary exercises to improve physical fitness. Overall, the American College of Sports Medicine recommends at least 30 minutes of exercise 3 to 5 times a week. But even if that is not attainable for the reasons we discussed earlier, because of fatigue or just feeling nauseated, the biggest thing to keep in mind is that any exercise is better than no exercise. And so whatever patients can do, I always encourage them to try.
And so your answer makes me think whenever patients or really anyone who wants to exercise a little bit more, whenever they ask the question, what exercise should I be doing? I know often the answer is, well, what do you like to do? That's the thing you're going to stick with. And so based on the clinical evidence you just reviewed, when you're thinking about the right exercise for cancer patients, does anything come to mind that you have particularly noticed to be effective? And on top of that question, where should patients with cancer start? And then also, does having a rehab program in the facility help?
To address the first part, I absolutely agree. You know, the most important part of exercise is just doing it. We can talk about whether moderate intensity or high intensity resistance exercise, you know, weightlifting, impact training. But I think the overall point is just doing something, going out there and exercising is the most important thing of all. So I will absolutely agree with that statement. You know, whatever you like doing, we will encourage you to do that. Building on that, we will try to customize our exercise programs to our patients. So that's why I will say, you know, while the information I give is a summary of much of the research that's been done in the field, I would always encourage patients to discuss this with their doctor, their physician, so they can go over what exercise program or plan may be right for them given their circumstances. I will say, you know, one of the hottest areas of exercise science these days is something called high-intensity interval training, which you may have heard about in the popular news. It's the idea where you do 1 minute of very intense exercise, followed by 1 minute of low or moderate intense exercise, and you repeat those intervals, high-intensity, low, moderate intensity, 10 times over the course of a half-hour workout. We are fans of high-intensity interval training in our program, especially because there's evidence to support that you can see quicker gains with high-intensity interval training, which would help with a lot of patients who may come to us not necessarily in fit shape or condition, and it's a way to quickly get them up and running, so to speak. But at the same time, as you point out, not all these programs are easily accessible or readily available to everyone. Certainly, I think having exercise programs within cancer centers is a major advantage, and if possible, to seek consultation with your local providers and see what programs are available. But if not, there's an opportunity to go online and find programs. But again, I would suggest talking with your physician to find out what resources are available to you or if there are specific online resources that they would recommend for you. And then, having the access to a program is one thing. It's not just adherence and getting up and exercising, but also following the quality of the program. One of our research studies, our clinical trials that we have ongoing actually for our high intensity interval training program, pairs the exercise program with a mobile health platform where we give all our patients an iPhone and an Apple Watch. And the reason we do this is so that we can monitor their exercise sessions at home. Exercise studies have been done based out of a cancer center or a facility affiliated with the cancer center, requiring patients to come back and forth multiple times a week. Because our patients live over an hour away most of the time, such distance becomes challenging. And so we've looked at technology to help support home-based interventions and monitoring patients in that setting, such that when they're exercising at home, we can actually see what their heart rate does during their exercise sessions and then provide follow-up coaching and feedback, depending on if we think they're not exercising hard enough, or in some cases, they may actually be pushing themselves too hard and could be hurting themselves that way. So I think having that kind of support is essential.
So you mentioned high-intensity interval training as a way to see some fairly swift changes. I wanted to ask a follow-up question about that, which really is, how much exercise might a cancer patient need at a minimum to see benefits?
I mean, really, at a minimum, I would say just getting up, will help. To flip it on the converse side of things, if you're just lying in bed doing nothing all day, you can lose up to 1% of your muscle mass every day. You're just lying there doing nothing. My patients who are in the hospital, those are often my sickest patients. They're in the heat of their transplant and they're in the sickest time. They are dealing with nausea and fatigue and they don't want to get out of bed. I tell them, look, just get up, get out of your room, go in the hall. If you can walk laps in the hall, that's great. But at least get up and get out. And if you get out of your room and you feel dizzy or you feel nauseated and you don't want to walk, that's okay. But I want you to at least make that initial effort. Because again, I think just anything that you can do certainly helps. But in terms of what a goal that patients should shoot for, again, I would go to the American College of Sports Medicine and say 30 minutes a day, 3 to 5 days a week would be the goal that I would set for my patients.
So keeping that in mind, how does nutrition fit in with exercise to improve muscle health and overall outcomes? And are there certain types of food or macronutrients that patients should really focus on to help them build muscle for themselves?
That's a great question. I think nutrition and exercise go hand in hand. You look at high performance athletes, right? And not only do they have trainers, but they also have dietitians and nutritionists as part of their team, because that's essential to help build up strength and muscle mass. And again, our cancer patients, I'm not looking for them to become, world-class athletes or bodybuilders or athletes, but because of the stresses of their treatment, they're going to lose muscle mass just from the treatment itself, from what they're going through. And so whatever they can do to counteract that, to build muscle mass, to maintain muscle mass is essential. Many cancer patients have poor nutritional status to begin with. They often come in and begin therapy with low muscle mass, which is a predictor for poor quality of life, increased treatment complications, and decreased survival. And improving muscle mass, improving nutrition can improve cancer outcomes and morbidity as well as mortality. And so that's why our goals are to especially targeting patients who are at risk of being underweight or malnourished to enhance their nutrition, to improve their muscle mass, to improve their health side by side with improving their exercise. At our institution, we actually have a program, a pre-peri and post-transplant optimization program, which is modeled in part on comprehensive geriatric assessment, where we evaluate every patient's physical function as well as their nutritional status. And if we have any concerns in those areas, we have them meet with a physical therapist or we have them meet with a dietitian. Oftentimes we have them meet with both so they can help improve their nutrition, improve their function, and again, ultimately improve their cancer outcomes. For patients who are at risk of being underweight, again, it's hard to give general advice. I think everything should be individualized and personalized to patients, but in general, I would say that they should try to maintain their nutrition. They should try to get adequate protein intake as well as fruits and vegetables into their diet. For some of my patients who have bad chemotherapy-induced mucositis, which is damage to their mucous membranes, like their mouth, their throat, that makes it difficult to swallow, I'll say, you know, it's if you can't eat solid foods, go with liquids, you know, go with protein shakes and smoothies. Even if it's a matter of just getting ice cream into your body, if you just need the calories, you know, go with that and maybe throw some protein powder in there. But, you know, whatever we can to improve that nutrition. And again, with the help of our dietitians and nutritionists in the care of these patients. And I touched there a little bit on types of food or macronutrients that you had asked about. Again, I think it depends on the individual, but overall, I would say proteins, fruits and vegetables, whole grains are excellent ways to maintain muscle mass or to prevent muscle loss, and that go hand in hand with exercise in terms of improving overall function and fitness.
Thank you. That's such great insight. And, you know, clearly we need muscle to exercise, and as we build it, we need to hold on to it. So what are some ways to protect that usable muscle so patients can exercise?
There's a lot of things that patients can do to protect that usable muscle. Prehabilitation, I think, is one way. And I know that's the subject of the second podcast, so I'm not going to speak too much about it here. But I think as far ahead of things as you can get in terms of helping patients exercise, eat right, build up those reserves before they begin therapy, especially because it can be so challenging during therapy with those chemotherapy and related side effects. But overall, I think, you know, emphasizing that 30 minutes a day, 3 to 5 times a week is beneficial. You know, proteins, fruits, and vegetables are beneficial. If you are just feeling too tired, if you're feeling weak, doing whatever you can, you know, pushing yourself as much as you can. And again, I return to what I tell my patients. I hear that you are tired. I hear that you're fatigued. I hear that you don't want to eat anything, but at least try. Get out of your room, you know, get into the hall, take a sip of that protein smoothie, just start as much as you can. And once you start, you might find that you'll be able to do more. And that's how we build on these things.
So I know your team is working on a clinical trial. Do you mind telling us a little bit more?
One of the things I haven't touched upon, but is dear to my heart and interest as an associate director of the Duke Microbiome Center, is the role of the bacteria in your body, you know, and how those microbes interact to shape human health and disease. We actually share our bodies with trillions of microorganisms, bacteria, viruses, and fungi. And scientists estimate they actually comprise about 3% of our body weight. You know, someone like me, maybe about 5 pounds of bacteria living in me. And they help modulate health and disease in a number of ways. Our studies have shown that modulating the microbiome can improve transplant outcomes in our murine models. We are now engaged in clinical trials of these strategies to see if they work in people. But also in terms of clinical trials and COVID-19, which is a very important topic at the moment, there's data to suggest that the microbiome, the bacteria in your body, can help protect you against COVID-19. Certain probiotics may be able to protect against respiratory viral infections, including COVID-19. So we actually have a trial of probiotics to eliminate COVID-19 transmission in exposed household contacts or protect EHC. The study is for patients who live with someone who's been diagnosed with COVID-19. And if you find out that you are in this situation, if someone's been diagnosed with COVID-19 in the last 48 hours, we would encourage you to reach out to us. We have a website, sites.duke.edu/protect-EHC. That's sites.duke.edu/protect-EHC, one word there. And you may be eligible to enroll in our study where we will randomize you to either receive probiotics or just a common food additive to see if that can help improve the microbiome, the bacteria in your gut, and help protect you against COVID-19.
Sounds like a fascinating trial, definitely important work. And I wanted to thank you for using this podcast to build awareness for that. And I also really want to thank you for your time today, because oncology and nutrition is such an important topic, and we're really grateful you were able to share your insights with us today.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. For our listeners, I mentioned this for a moment in the introduction, but in case you'd like a quick reminder, this recording is just one in a series of three podcast episodes spinning off of our recent Nutrition and Oncology Roundtable. Next, we'll catch up with Dr. Chelsea Aguilis, who will discuss preoperative and rehabilitation nutrition. And then we'll close out the series with Dr. Martin Chasen, who will talk to us about multimodal interventions in cancer patients with and without cachexia. You can find these recordings on ANHI.org by clicking resources at the top of the page and then podcasts and videos. And we've also created a knowledge hub that showcases all of our oncology content. So you can find that by clicking resources and knowledge hub. And with all of that said, thanks so much for listening. We hope this content was helpful and that you can use it to help your patients throughout their cancer journey. Thanks, everyone. Stay healthy and safe.